You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today's date is the 24th of June, 2025. This is when this is being recorded. And this is titled, A Cornered and Wounded Animal, The Irrationality of Zionist Foreign Policy and the Death of an Empire. Now, last week, I stated that direct American involvement in striking Iran was unlikely. Possible, but hard to picture, if no other reason than it was irrational. And of course, as soon as I recorded that, the U.S. did intervene, although very briefly, and in fact did very little. In fact, it was so terrible that it radically shifted the trajectory of the war entirely. In response, Iran struck American bases, one in particular, the largest one. And rather than demand more war, the American president sought conciliation. The bombing of these empty sites a few days ago was a risky gamble, and the U.S. lost. As you know, the regime declared war in Iran on June 13th, although, of course, it did long before then, but more directly on June 13th. But then, a more subtle war began on that very same day. Israel was faced with a crushing blow, not just from Operation True Promise III, but from both the Houthis as well as Hezbollah. Operation True Promise, of course, is the Iranian counterattack, launched in self-defense after Tel Aviv killed about 400 Iranians, including senior officials and academics specializing in nuclear energy. But then, given the nature of the response, the Israelis imposed a draconian level of censorship. But like everything that they've done recently, it's failed globally. It's designed to hide battlefield losses, but this is a major censorship and propaganda blitz. It's an organized suppression from information bans and occupied territories, even the manipulation of the algorithm from Silicon Valley. It's more than just corruption, but it's also a sign of defeat and mortal terror. It's being run by General Kobi Mendebilt, the Rising Lion Directive, issued on June 17th, and criminalized any information put out without state approval about strike locations, especially those near military installations, or any exact locations of strike zones. It's not exactly a sign of victory. The directive prohibits any mention of interceptor launches or footage of missiles hitting their targets in Israel. Even social media posts have to be approved by the state. So it was the 20th or the 19th of June. Police in Haifa, which is really Israel's second city, raided several foreign television stations filming the bombing of the city's huge oil refinery and power grid. They confiscated laptops and cameras. But even with that, images and videos are still finding their way to the web. The morgues of Israeli military hospitals are filled to overflowing with dead soldiers, while the IDF, of course, officially claims minimal casualties. Soldiers either wounded or killed have had their identities classified. Turns out it's far more than dozens. The BBC had to admit that they were banned officially from covering, for example, the destruction of the Weizmann Institute of Science, which is a military and intelligence facility that now is completely destroyed. Missile strikes, a very successful one from Iran, have led to a situation similar to Gaza. Massive secrecy, especially concerning places destroyed, as well as military deaths. It's a full-scale disinformation campaign, and it applies to the more recent Iranian attacks, the American base in Qatar. Many of you know for a long time, Assad has what they call extensive troll farms that populate social media with AI-generated characters, videos, and pictures, the purpose of which is to drown out any false, what they consider false narratives, and to shape social media in favor of Israel. They have all kinds of edited footage that show successful strikes on Iranian missile launchers. But even I could see that changing the contrast level and the camera angle, it's very easy to show that what appeared to be a precise strike turned out to be a minor hit, but can be manipulated to look like a large-scale victory or strike on something of significance. They're releasing footage showing strikes on decoy launchers as if they were real targets. But it goes even beyond that. During the critical stages of Israel's war against Iran, Twitter blocked the account of the former Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, attacking Netanyahu, calling him a genocidal coward, saying that Iran didn't start this war, but it will certainly decide how it ends, which turned out to be true. His account was removed. Of course, he knew why. Because big tech seems to have the power to decide which world leaders are heard and which are suppressed, making them, by the way, legitimate military targets. Early on, the Jewish-owned Meta, Facebook, approved more than 100,000 requests over 24 hours to remove any anti-Israel content while promoting official Israeli military posts as if these were research facts. This is called Hasbara 2.0. It's a state-funded network of online trolls. All kinds of fake infographics and artificially viral social media posts, hashtags, released by the Israeli state. One of the big companies doing this is Percepto International. They use bots that pose as outraged citizens, trying to sway Western opinion. The propaganda outlets, largely owned by Jews like Reuters, Axios, Wall Street Journal, are regularly briefed by Israeli agents, including the Unit 8200 employees who actually work directly in their newsrooms. The latest lie, which I just came across, is that Israel is fighting wildfires started by arsonists. Now, I came across the debunking of this nonsense. The pictures and video that they're using is from Thailand. Fires in 2021, they're traced to a Facebook account, a post from June 9th of that year. Yes, the country is ablaze, but not from wildfires. Given the total media blackout, there is no reliable news from Israel or anywhere else, but there are solid sources of information that once this gets published, you'll see where my sources are from. Seeking out real information, then, is a challenge. It requires a tremendous amount of experience, intellectual acumen, and honesty, all of which I so happen to possess. But regardless, all of this shows that Iran is winning. Iranian sorties are showing greater accuracy and effectiveness. And it looks like both the Americans and certainly the Israelis are running out of interceptor ammunition. Israel uses a multi-layered air defense, the three levels being the Arrow, the lowest level, David's Sling, and then the Iron Dome, which were operating at a very reduced capacity and now are not operating at all. Iran has only now started using its more sophisticated weapons. One of them hit a major military target in Beersheba, showing evasive capabilities that rendered even real interceptors completely ineffective. Those interceptors cost about $200 million a day to operate. It was in crisis in early June. It was in crisis at the time of the invasion of Lebanon. So today, these are mostly non-operational. The U.S. is cobbling together a few weapons from Oman, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. But these are also now depleted. This is how we know that the Iranian counterattack against the U.S. was a success. It's all a pattern. Every Iranian or Hezbollah missile attack is said to have been totally intercepted, but later it's revealed to be pure propaganda. The Islamic Guard spokesman, Lieutenant Colonel Aman Tajik, said that as early as the 19th, Israeli airspace was completely unprotected. A precision strike in the Gavyam Technology Park, which is what the Israelis tried to say was a civilian hospital, destroyed intelligence servers and reduced key laboratories to nothing. The information now used by the American president, these idiot journalists, sheltered academics, and politicians, they come from two main sources. The first group is better known, Israeli officials, make-believe analysts, journalists, the stock of American public intellectuals reading from scripts. The second is less known. These are former Iranian citizens that have fled the country, and they make a good living condemning the Iranian government. Sayed Ghasminejad, who's a liberal economist, Murad Vesey, who's the feminist Maisa Alinejad, known for her purely emotional appeals, Mariam Mermersadiqi, who only lived in the country a short time as a child, and the weirdo poet Jamshid Barzgar, who knows very little about comparative politics. These are the people who are being used to promote this agenda. None of them are qualified to provide any kind of deep analysis on the Iranian government. Their main language is English. They've all been educated outside of Iran, and they hate their own country, and allows them to support terrorists and foreign aggressors, even advisors on how to kill more Iranians to the extent that they're useful at all. So those two groups, of course, to a man, mirror the interests of both Tel Aviv and Washington. These are the people where the so-called nuclear weapon idea derived. Early on, the Zionist, the Washington Post, had said that their headline was, Tehran may turn to a nuclear bomb. Newsweek said that Iran may have to build a nuclear bomb. The so-called Iranian refugees at Iran International said that current conditions could push Iran to build a nuclear weapon. These are all headlines, all saying the same thing, using the same rhetoric, of course meaning that there's no coincidence, and none of them provide any evidence for their claims. Although certainly Iran has every right now, especially now, but always, to build whatever weapon they need to defend themselves. So, evening of June 22nd, the U.S. attacked Iran, sort of. Strategic bombers and submarines launched a strike only on three nuclear sites that were empty. Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan. Donald Trump, of course, prematurely announced its tremendous success. The only thing it did was bring Yemen directly into the war. The Iranians knew it was coming. The Iranians saw American preparations. The U.S. moved two groups of B-2s with the radar codes MYTEE-11-FLT and MYTEE-21-FLT, taking off from Whitman Air Force Base in Missouri, moving towards Guam. They used their strategic tankers, the KC-135. That had been taken off from Altus, Oklahoma Air Force Base. But at that time, even the Pentagon was saying that there's no orders for these to be used. But regardless of whatever happened, and very little happened there, Iran is upping its strikes and using even superior weaponry than before to attack the Israelis. Iran has been prepared and planning for this for decades. Tel Aviv and Haifa are on fire. Now, it's legitimate to ask the question, how do you know that the U.S. is lying about its attacks? And the answer is very complex, and it's beyond the capacity of any journalist. See, in August of 2020, Iran revealed a new method of basing solid-fuel ballistic missiles in underground launchers. In these deep valleys, it eliminates the line of sight for standoff reconnaissance. They'll provide some protection against even conventional or even nuclear weapons. Some of them are small enough to disguise them as civilian trucks. Liquid-fueled missiles are a bit more complicated. Iran prefers to use the liquid fuels because of its superior performance, mostly intermediate range. It allows for heavier payloads and longer ranges. And they can be stored without any risk of explosion, and they're very attractive for deep tunnel construction. They're stored dry, without fuel. Their service life is almost unlimited. They're designed to last for several generations. You need well-trained crews to fuel and handle these. Iran's new generation of missiles is top of the line. They use fuel and oxidizer combinations that really can't be used at high temperatures, though. So while the solid-fueled Silil-2 can travel hundreds of miles disguised as a civilian truck and hide anywhere, the other liquid-fueled missiles can't really operate that far from its base. The deep tunnel complexes, which include these nuclear sites, there's nothing new about that. China and North Korea have been using it for a long time. Iran calls them missile cities because of their size and their scale. These bases are buried so deeply in the mountains that their arsenal is protected from nuclear strikes. Bunker busters will have no effect. The only real vulnerability is the entrances, but they have excavators and other construction equipment that could either reopen the entrance or even create alternative emergency exits. The bunker buster is not really as effective as the U.S. might claim. It doesn't matter whether they're delivered by manned aircraft or special means, a GBU-57 or whatever. They're under many meters of soft rock that could be penetrated, including several concrete slabs. Penetration drops sharply to a few meters when you're dealing with hard granite rock formations, especially when that's reinforced with high-performance composite concrete. That's why you know that the American attacks were miserable failures. So the impact of even nuclear weapons, let alone conventional ones, on these targets inside the tunnel complexes are non-existent. At a minimum, they're from 50 to 100 meters. And they're reliable, and they have crews for rapid repair if absolutely necessary. So continuous operation is guaranteed. It's extremely important to understand this. The entire arsenal is located here. Granite rock formations native to Iran can withstand 300 kiloton contact blasts delivered by thermonuclear ballistic missiles, around 100 meters, and it goes up to 300 if anchor bolts and mesh line tunnels are used. It's typical for deep missile storage areas, and it's the same for these nuclear sites, which were empty to begin with. Entry areas have a granite, what they call a granite overburden, 50 meters roughly. That can be heavily damaged, but it takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of luck to hit them, but it does take a lot of time to free and clear them. But only multiple hits over a long period of time can disable one of these, and that was certainly not the case recently. Missile cities are designed for withstanding nuclear strikes. They're of the cave silo type. They don't require an entry zone large enough for any launchers to operate, and missiles can be launched from inside the mountain through a vertical shaft, dozens of meters long. So long as that remains clear, launch operations can continue. Even precision nuclear weapons are ineffective, let alone the bunker buster, which are very overhyped to begin with. So, around that same time, November 2020, the Iranians, remember, a highly scientific first world country, they developed a new concept for loading ballistic missiles. It's a high-mobility electric rail car system carrying 5 ready-to-launch liquid-fueled missiles loaded into a semi-automated erector system. It's like a carousel magazine that allows for continuous parallel loading operations. And they're small enough that accuracy, it has to really, it's like a Death Star. You know, it has to be extremely good luck to hit it, and it has to be direct, and it has to be repetitive. It's deep enough to require a steep angle of attack weapon trajectory. Not to mention, many of them are situated within valleys. That complicates trajectory issues. It's almost impossible to hit. So this is even more evidence that the American claims for its attack are complete lies. These are bored into solid granite rock. And as I said, there's many other reinforcing mechanisms. ICBM silos are designed to remain intact, not just from thermonuclear weapons, but they use cold launches rather than the hot launches that the Americans use. I mentioned that the last time. Cold launch methods don't require ignition. It's a gas thrust that pushes them out and only ignites when it gets out of the silo. The Americans use the hot launch, which means the silo is already destroyed. So the Iranians have a superior system to anything the Americans have, even in that department. And there's many alternatives if one is destroyed or one is harmed, in the rare occasion that might happen. So these huge complexes of deep missile storage bays, and it's all the same, it's the exact same thing for the nuclear enrichment facilities. As I mentioned, anchor bolts and mesh lining, these polymer-lined compartments. So even a super lucky and repetitive hit does minor damage, if that. And these are usually in sparsely populated areas, and they have a very high mountain topology and tremendously solid rock formations. That makes it work. Not every country has this. It has a capacity that no other country has. So it's very hard for me to believe that the full combat complement dropped at the GBU-57 in the Iranian nuclear facility at Fedora, for example, that was immediately followed by a strike of 30 Tomahawks from American submarines far away, did very much damage. I mean, the attacks on Yemen did nothing. And now that's the international consensus. Submarines were about 400 miles away. But any media report is coming directly from the U.S. military, or at least the Israeli military. After this happened, Trump gave his address, and he said, "Tonight I could tell you the world that these strikes were remarkable military successes. Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and utterly destroyed. Iran, the bully of the Middle East, must now take a step towards peace. If they do not, future attacks will be far more widespread and far easier to carry out." But at the time, this was immediately afterwards, no one, except people who actually were there, had any idea if anything ever was damaged at all. You see, the bunker bombs were designed to cut through concrete floors when falling. Their maximum penetration is about 61 meters, or 19 meters of reinforced concrete. We know that there was no damage to any nuclear site, A, because they were empty, and B, because even the Atomic Agency says the radiation levels outside of Iran's facilities have not increased. The UN condemned the whole thing, saying that this was a direct threat to international peace and security. Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General, said this is a dangerous escalation in a region already on edge and a direct threat to international peace and security. And then, of course, there's Scott Ritter, who I've quoted many, many times, an American former UN arms control inspector, who he resigned there. He's been monitoring Iran's compliance from the very beginning. He called Trump a national disgrace, and he said this: "He bombed three empty sites using the most sophisticated strike system in the U.S. arsenal. Two of them, Natanz and Esfahan, were previously hit by Israel anyway. A third, Fordo, was undamaged. You really are the dumbest people. The 60% enriched uranium was totally intact. The IR-6 and IR-8 centrifuges were still intact. All sensitive equipment was evacuated. The only thing stopping Iran from going nuclear now is Iran not wanting a nuclear weapon, no matter how much you wanted to have one. Trump is a national disgrace. You are an embarrassment to the country." How stupid would they have to be, knowing that this was coming, being aware that this was coming, to have everything still there? Especially after the Israelis failed to hit it. Why would they keep it there? Think of the mentality that goes into this. Now, the Democrats, who are the exact same, they're the exact same way towards Israel, but they're using this as a way to demand Trump's impeachment without getting any approval from Congress. They're right to do this, but they're not going to reject Israel over it. called it a violation of the Constitution because the legislative body does have war powers. That's to reduce everything to a technicality. I've read Bernie Sanders' bill trying to control Trump's war powers against Iran without congressional approval. And I noticed in the four pages of the thing, it has an exception for self-defense, which today is a vague and meaningless concept. So the bill, even if it goes through, is meaningless. But you have to be an idiot not to realize that the strike was for political purposes only. Nothing was damaged. It was just limited to statements. Trump announced the success right away, knowing that he didn't really know. The Israeli lobby was pleased. Yemen now has continued its strikes on American ships. Israel announces gratitude to the U.S. The Iranians announce, of course, that there was no damage. There's no doubt in my mind, given everything I've said, that there's no damage at all to these nuclear sites, even if they weren't empty. In fact, it was some time ago, according to Hassan Abedini, the deputy political director for Iranian television, that it was some time ago that these were removed. In the Iranian parliament, Manan Raisi, who represents the Qom people, he said in an interview with the a military news agency, Tasnim, he said, "Based on accurate information, I could state that, contrary to the claims of the lying U.S. president, the nuclear facility at Fordno was not seriously damaged. Whatever was damaged was limited to the land that could be easily restored. The U.S. nor Israel have any clue of what damage was done. Even the Israelis said it was too early to draw any kind of conclusions. CNN reported, citing an unnamed Israeli official, that additional intelligence, including radio intercepts, are needed for any kind of accurate assessment, which will take time. The point being that the claim of immediate success has to be a lie. You have satellite imagery from Maxar Technologies showing unusual activity at the Fordo nuclear site on the 19th of June, a long line of vehicles waiting outside an entrance to the facility. And of course, the purpose there was to get everything out. Most of the highly enriched uranium had been moved to an undisclosed location before the U.S. attack, as is the only rational thing they could have possibly done. So, immediately after claiming success, Trump contacted the Iranian authorities and said that the U.S. attack was over and the strikes were not aimed at overthrowing the regime, which is very odd. Trump has contradicted himself a few times after that, but this is the first time that a power has struck an operating nuclear facility. The closest thing in the past was the 1981 Operation Opera that destroyed an unfinished Iraqi nuclear reactor located 11 miles southeast of Baghdad. The Iranian Air Force tried to do it before, only caused minor damage. This was being run by the French anyway. It was meant and designed to be a research reactor, incapable of producing anything, certainly not weapons, and was run by the French anyway. As I've said 100 times, the point is to keep Iraq poor, or Iran in this case, poor, and no one seriously believed that it could be a weapons facility anyway. This is called the Begin Doctrine, that explicitly states that the strike was not an anomaly. This sets a precedent for every future government in Israel that any kind of nuclear power, or even nuclear research, has to be destroyed. In the Opera cases, 1976, Iraq purchased what's called the OSIRIS-class research nuclear reactor from France, again, run by the French. The OSIRIS reactor was intended for peaceful scientific research. It was designed for that. The Israelis knew that, but said anyway that it was designed to produce nuclear weapons. After the attack, Israel somehow called the operation an act of self-defense, and then said that it had less than a month before it went critical. I think that means that it was close to failing or melting down. I don't know what else critical can mean in this case. It killed a French civilian. 10 Iraqi soldiers were killed. But Israeli terrorism is nothing new here, because around that same time, Mossad agents in France, in 1979, planted a bomb that destroyed the reactor's first set of core structures in France while they were awaiting shipment to Iraq, right on French soil. June of 1980, Mossad agents assassinated Yahya Mashhad, an Egyptian atomic scientist working on the Iraqi nuclear program. Two other Iraqi engineers working on the program, Salman Rashid and Abdul Rasul, suddenly fell ill and died on a skiing trip to Switzerland and France, respectively, poisoned by the Israelis, poisoned by military intelligence. So all of this is nothing new. The rhetoric, the murders, this is old news. Now, the massive ordnance penetrator, the bunker buster, the MOP, are large enough that they can only be carried by the Northrop Grumman B-2 stealth bombers. As I said, the Navy then launched 30 Tomahawks. I don't think anyone's quite sure the vessel that fired them. I think it's the USS Georgia, because it had been in the Indian Ocean since at least September. First time that the MOPs have been used in combat. Each weighs about 14 tons. The B-2 is the only thing that could carry it. 37 hours between takeoff and the attack, and it was refueled multiple times in the air. I did say on Saturday that a lot of refueling tankers have been seen operational, so maybe there will be some kind of an American operation. The Pentagon insists that Iranian air defenses didn't engage due to Israeli damage, but even that is very unsure at this point. There were about 125 aircraft in total, because there was a diversionary move over the Pacific. The B-2s went over the Atlantic. People like Drago Bosnich and myself have mentioned the huge cost of this operation. Each B-2 costs about $4 billion. As he would say, they're extremely complex and logistically demanding aircraft. It costs $150,000 per hour to keep it in the air, and 150 hours of maintenance for each hour in the sky. USAF has been incapable of deploying no more than 5 or 6 at the same time, so that 7 flew to attack Iran, with more used as a distraction, meaning maybe 2 or 3, means that 10 flew at once, which is unlikely. There's only 19 operational, on paper anyway. So most of the fleet was involved in the operation. That too is very doubtful. The tremendous stress, the 30 tons of payload, each one over 18 hours, creates a tremendous amount of stress for an aircraft already overstretched and overused due to the small size of the fleet. So flying alone to Iran and back would be over $5 million each. So $55 million at a minimum, if 10 were actually used. One of these bombs costs about $20 million each. 14 were allegedly dropped. So 14 times 20, at a minimum, $280 million. The Tomahawks themselves, each one is $2 million. So you're talking about $350 million just in munitions alone. You're talking about 125 aircraft at least used. So the cost was in the billions, just for this, just for nothing. And why was it explained in such great detail? It's just propaganda. Donald Trump has very limited knowledge of any kind of advanced military equipment. The implication was only the U.S. could conduct something like this. But it seems to be an overly complex operation to hit 3 or 4 targets. Let's say Russia wanted to do it. And I'm quoting Bosnich here, but it's been clear to me for some time. If Russia wanted to do it, or the Chinese wanted to do it, they would just send one single Oreshnik armed with 36 advanced kinetic penetrators to obliterate anything in the radius of 4,300 miles. That's all it would take. So why is the U.S. using World War II style bombings? Trump's first term, he attacked what he claimed were ISIS targets in Afghanistan. In this case, it was a GBU-43B, the massive ordnance air blast, the second most powerful non-nuclear weapon in the world. Only the Russians have the thermobaric ATBIP. But of course, he was not going to attack ISIS, since they're allies. The media claimed it was this tremendous victory, but nothing happened. It was a failure then, too. So you have an obvious pattern that seems to be invisible to establishment journalists. Israel is in more trouble than I think even I realize. There's an anti-Israel hacker group, Cyber Istanet Front, carried out a large-scale cyber operation targeting the core of Israel's military-industrial complex, and it disabled key components of its offensive weapons systems. A significant portion of Israel's security infrastructure and military industry had been hacked and infected with cyber disruptors, advanced ones. This is a massive disruption of Israeli military action, products. The group reported this targeted cyber attack was directed at strategic and sensitive technological areas. One of the most notable consequences was the failure of Rafael, a well-known Israeli arms manufacturer operating under the auspices of the Ministry of Defense. They sent a bug in, CR Casting Exact, it's called, and it caused several military products to malfunction. And really, the full impact is not going to become apparent over the next few weeks. So what little the Israelis have left is not even functioning. This is just one stage for them in this larger campaign to degrade Israel's ability to conduct any kind of offensive operation. Its Telegram channel suggests that a large portion of Israel's military has been disabled. The infrastructure has been disabled. And yet the Israeli attack, there was one attack on the Iranian, a cyber attack on the Iranian military that was successful for a very short time. Then the Israelis also tried to attack the central bank, state-owned central bank of Iran, and that failed miserably. Starting in June 17th, there were extensive cyber attacks on the country's banking network, but there wasn't a single disruption to banking services during the war. Mohammad Reza Farzin is the chief banker of the state, and nothing changed. Nothing was disrupted. The flow continued. The bank Sapa, which is Iran's largest bank, actually have the accounts of the armed forces there, and the CBI, the central bank of Iran, was totally unaffected. Iran is well stocked with food and ammunition and energy for a long time. Obviously, they've been preparing for this for ages. But nothing really in the country has been affected all that much in Iran. There was an announcement from the National Nuclear Safety Center. And there's a lot of Americans who really can't come to terms with the miserable failure of the attacks, of the American attacks or the Israeli ones. The National Nuclear Safety Center says that there was no contamination. But even if they had been successful, that would have been a tremendous war crime by itself. They say that no signs of contamination have been detected. Now the second agency, they say so. Therefore, there's no danger to residents living near these facilities. But the Mossad agents have been broken up. There's been 53 more Iranians in the Fars province connected with these strikes that have been rounded up, and few have been executed already. Now, as far as the Al-Udeid Air Base in Qatar, the regime, of course, says that all of these missiles were shot down. It's highly unlikely. The damage will be kept under wraps, at least for the time being. I've seen a few videos that have found their way through showing the missiles hitting the base. But as always, the U.S. will claim zero casualties. But over time, the truth will be gradually admitted, at least by others. This only occurred after a high-level meeting in Russia, suggesting that Moscow gave the green light for this. Many of you may not have heard, but the Danish shipping giant, Maersk, they're suspending all vessel calls to the Israeli city port of Haifa because of the strikes by Iran. They said after careful analysis of threat reports related to the ongoing conflict between Israel and Iran, in particular the potential risks of calling at specific Israeli ports and their impact on the safety of our crews, Maersk has decided to temporarily suspend vessel calls to the port of Haifa in Israel, as well as suspend cargo reception in that city. That means the Israeli economy, which is in trouble in the first place, now has ground to a halt. There's little left in that city. Hafia is their big technology and military center, other than Tel Aviv, and it's now on fire. Same thing goes for Ashdod, Israeli regime's second largest transportation hub. It's close to Gaza. The Bazan Group oil refinery, which is Israel's largest in Hafia, is now on fire. Maritime trade is now non-existent. It's 100% is shut down. Hafia handles about more than a third of Israeli's container traffic, Israel's container traffic. So now they have no imports. Insurance companies are pulling out entirely, as if that's not bad enough, or jacking premiums very high up. Their last port of Eilat, which once linked Israel to Asian markets via the Red Sea, has now been shut down entirely. And on top of that, Yemen has shut down the El Mandeb Strait. That's been going on since 2023, but now they've increased it. Cargo volume overall has gone down 92%. The war economy alone is losing more than $200 million a day, which is a very low estimate. But that's not her total economic losses, which are immense. It seems that most of the Israeli Iron Dome or Arrow 3 missiles are gone. Even the lowest level, the Arrow 3, cost $4 million each. Most of their launchers have been destroyed. They're not as protected as the Iranians are. Power grids have shut down power everywhere. The hilarious hit on the Microsoft data center at Beersheba, which was great, one of the best things they could have done, because they were cooperating with the Israeli military. Their computer operations are gone. So what do we say? What do we conclude from all of this? What came of all of this? What came of the American attack, the failed attack on Iran's nuclear industry? Well, number one, Iran's nuclear infrastructure is totally undamaged, or if it's affected, only slightly. Number two, it's now certain that enrichment's going to continue. It will continue with minimal disruption. Number three, Israel's now incapable of attacking Iran. There haven't been any attacks in quite some time now. Number four, several countries have already said they're going to supply Iran with their nuclear arsenal, including Russia, China, and Pakistan. Number five, Israel, its cities are on fire. Its bloodthirsty people are panicking. Its media shut down. Sixth, Israel's murderous settlers are now facing missile barrages, which is a wonderful thing. Number seven, the U.S. is drawn into a conflict now that it simply can't win. Eight, Iran's government remains totally intact, stable, and more unified than ever. And yet, number nine, the Israeli and American governments are bitterly divided and unstable. 10, Iran's trade with Russia and China has increased over the last few months. 11, Iran's economy is growing. While the Israeli economy is ablaze, the non-oil part of the economy has grown not quite 1% over the last few months. 12, Israel and the U.S. are now exposed yet again as terror states. 13, Iran's economy is stable, but the Israeli and the U.S. are not. 14, Iran's population, including its former opponents, are rallying around its leadership. 15, Trump, who was elected as a peacemaker president, has started a new war, has alienated his own supporters. 16, and don't underestimate this, Turkey has officially sided with Iran. 17, the Mossad infiltrators in Iran have been exposed and many of them have been executed. 18, trying to claim that a war for Israel is the heart of America first, which is what Trump has said. It makes him sound ridiculous and ignorant. Number 19, the elite media is again exposed as just a propaganda agency without any kind of reliability. And finally, the vast majority of countries worldwide oppose all of this. And the perception of the Jews worldwide has been changed forever. Iran has withstood sustained pressure, and it has seized the initiative. The attempt here from the U.S. and Israel was, number one, to restore its deterrence targeting Israeli military commands and scientific elites, and number two, the U.S. wanted to dismantle Iran's nuclear infrastructure, fragment the military cohesion of the republic, but they failed on both counts. They can't do damage to the Iranian missile program. Iran has launched missile and drone attacks up until right this minute on all of Israel's major cities, demonstrating that it can continue to fight, that Israel's interceptor missiles are gone. Iran is a world power. Iran's internal cohesion is unshaken. And even just by itself, it can still project credible deterrence. There's been a key shift here. For the first time, a regional state directly targeted U.S. military interests in West Asia. But what was Washington's reaction? Not retaliation, but a rush towards de-escalation and calls for ceasefire. That's a shift. That's a huge shift. It's a recognition of her limited options. Just a few days earlier, Americans were talking about regime change in Iran, but now the rhetoric has been softened. Trump said, "May God protect Iran and Israel." That doesn't suggest strength whatsoever. The U.S., when it's confronted with a first-world motivated power, the U.S. will run. And in this case, that means quickly seeking conciliation. Iran has proven itself to be a regional hegemon at a minimum. It's pierced the crude lies of the Western media. It's proven the U.S. to be a paper tiger, as I've said 100 times before. No one trusts the U.S. anymore. As its diplomacy is just tactical regrouping. From the Iranian perspective, American diplomacy is just a tool. It's a tactical cover to buy time, to reorganize. So no one's going to listen to that anymore. Every peace ceasefire that Israel has ever been a party of, from 2006 to 2021, 2014, it's immediately violated at the first opportunity. Attacking Iran by both powers was a colossal error, and nothing is going to be the same ever again. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.